The Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, Episode 8. Over 40% of the United States presidents have had Irish ancestors. I'll show you Paris in the morning. I'll show you London afternoon. If you feel your Dublin heart is burning, yeah, well, you don't have to worry, because we're going there. Hello, travel nerds, and welcome to the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, the show that will inspire you to travel and then show you how to do it on any budget. I'm Trav, the creator of Extra Pack Peanuts, and with me today is a man who will not only inspire you to travel, not only give you great tips and tricks for traveling on a budget, but will also teach you to do something that you have probably been dreading since high school, and that is to learn a foreign language. It's the one and only Irish polyglot, Benny Lewis of FluentInThreeMonths.com. Benny, thanks for joining the show and welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Benny, let's just start with some of the details. At this point, how many different languages do you currently speak?
That, of course, would depend on how you define speak. But if it's from conversational and up, and this would be the European level B1, lower intermediate, it's about 11 or 12 languages. And then from more along the lines of mastery, like I could work professionally in the language and have deep conversations, 4 or 5. So it depends on if you're counting, you know, social conversational skills or deep mastery skills. But okay. Yeah, between those numbers.
Right. So, yeah. So 11 or 12 conversational languages and then, yeah, a mastery in, you know, at least 4 or 5 of them. What was the timeline then for you learning these languages? In what order did you kind of learn them?
Well, what definitely needs to be said first and foremost is that I do not have any language skills, which may sound counterintuitive to what I've just said, because I took German for 5 years in school and I barely passed it. And after I graduated with a degree in electronic engineering, I moved to Spain for 6 months. And I did not learn to speak Spanish in that time. I spoke only English. I tried to study a little and I got nowhere. So it's important to note that I could only speak English as an adult. And this is why I try to encourage other adult English speakers. And at first I learned my languages quite slowly because I tried a mostly academic approach. And then I slowly learned with time ways to improve on that, to make it work faster and more efficiently. And that's what I'm doing now. So it took me about a year and a half to reach the mastery level in Spanish, and then maybe a year to reach the same level in French, and then constantly reducing with the Latin languages. And now in general, the last languages I've taken, even though they're very, very different, Chinese and Arabic, for instance, in both cases, I've reached a conversational level in 3 months. Wow. I'm always aiming for fluency. Fluency for me would be a little bit higher than conversational, would be upper intermediate, where I could basically do whatever I wanted in social situations. I'm always aiming for that in 3 months. And I find I can definitely get a bit lower, and I'm always experimenting to see ways to improve on that.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, and you hammer this home on your website all the time, that you are not any type of language savant. You don't have any special skills that, you know, the normal person doesn't have, and that, you know, at I think you said at 21, you spoke one language, and it was English. And since then, yep, in the last, what has it been, 10 years, you've been able to add, you know, 11 or 12 languages over that span without any type of, yeah, like you said, native or natural ability other than just kind of perseverance and the desire to learn.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah, two of the things I'm sure you get all the time, this kind of builds on that, is A, I'm not good at learning languages. You know, I hear this from people all the time. Well, I'm just not good at learning it, or I'm not a natural. And the other is it's much easier to learn languages when you are young. So for those people who say that to you, what is kind of your response to that?
Well, the I'm not naturally talented one is quite a weak excuse if you really look at it, because over half the population of the planet is multilingual. And this includes people from Europe, the kind of heritage that Americans would claim. And and people from all over the world. So it's nothing genetic. The only reason people tend to be monolingual is purely cultural. This is, for me, a case closed in terms of nature versus nurture, that it's all about nurture. And that's something that we can change. We can change the environment that forced us to be monolingual. And like, we don't necessarily learn, we didn't learn so well in school because maybe that academic approach just wasn't good for us to learn the language. But saying that you don't have a language gene is nonsense, because people can presumably understand what I'm saying right now. So they have the gene to learn their first language. So it's basically just applying that to their second language. But as I said, trying to do it in a more natural way rather than it being about studying and so on. And in terms of being too old, there was actually a study done at the University of Haifa in Israel that found that under the right circumstances, adults are actually better language learners than children. The problem is that most of the time it is not the right, they are not the right circumstances that are applied. Like, if you think about it, a child will tend to learn a language better because they are playing in the language, they're living the language, they have friends in the language. Whereas an adult is much more typically going to click buttons in a software and buy dusty old grammar books and do all of these other tedious things that are not really necessary, or they're not core aspects of a language. And I always try to remind people that a language is a means of communication. And it's not a list of facts that you study. It's not about cramming as much words into your head as possible. It's about getting used to the language. So that's always my approach to it. It's not learning the language, but living and getting used to it. And this basically explains why most adults do not learn a language, is because they're not living the language. They're studying it as if it was a case of memorizing a million words. That's not it at all. And there are many, not myself, but many exceptions to this myth that you are too, like, there's a cutoff age to learning a language. And this cutoff age is actually, it's an old wives' tale, more or less, because what it refers to is feral children. And I would agree to the fact that it's unlikely that you would be able to learn your first language after the age of 14. There was a study shown that kind of confirms that this is the likely case. But that's not the case for your second language, because the rules are different. You have an advantage over a child because you have years of context and experience and an ability to extrapolate, and you can apply this to your second language and learn it much, much quicker.
Yeah, and that's one of the other questions I then had for you, is how much easier, or does it get easier, the more languages you learn, and why is that? And I think you touched on that a little bit, but if you wanted to explain that a little more.
Right. It does get easier. But the reasons would not be, in my opinion, would not necessarily be why people think they are. A lot of people have cited to me that maybe it's neurology, that my brain chemistry is changing or getting re-hardwired or whatever it is. But what I feel makes the biggest difference is confidence. When I was first trying to learn Spanish, I was not confident, and I was afraid that people would laugh at me when I made mistakes, that they'd be angry and that I'd accidentally call their mother a caterpillar or something. You know, there's all of these illogical fears that held me back from speaking the language. And by just diving in and fail fast and fail often, as my motto, I have learned with time to get over these illogical fears. And that is my big advantage now, having done this so many times. I know that the world is not going to end when I make a mistake. I know that it's a stepping stone on the path towards fluency. And that's why I do it a lot better now, is because I've embraced making mistakes. My whole philosophy, as I tell people, is to make at least 200 mistakes a day. I go out of my way to do that because I'm using the language when I have that learning philosophy. And it really is a change in mentality. And I can give people a little shortcut to getting to this stage, is if they were to take on a very, very easy language first and not have to worry about the complexities of learning a normal natural language, then they can get this confidence and then apply that to other languages. So I always suggest people take a couple of weeks, not a year or so, but a couple of weeks
to learn Esperanto, the world's easiest language. And you get used to the fact that you can speak a language. You get a bit of confidence. You get used to using different words to express concepts that you're well used to saying in English. And then after that, when you take on the next language, you have this certain polyglot edge, as I like to call it. And you have that confidence and you can apply it to a more complex language.
Yeah, and for people who don't know what Esperanto is, if you don't mind sharing kind of just what it is and again, why you suggest maybe starting with that if you're someone who just wants to learn how to learn a language.
Esperanto is an artificial invented language, but it is actually a lot bigger than people may think it is. It's, I believe, the 12th or 13th biggest language on Wikipedia. It's got more articles than Arabic does. There are large communities of Esperanto speakers that gather around, especially in Europe. You can meet up with hundreds of them and hang out for a week straight. And it's one of the easiest languages because it was designed to be easy. There are no exceptions to the grammar rules. You can learn the grammar in an afternoon, learn a few words, and then just start speaking it. This is why I recommend it, because you get this boost of confidence. You don't have to spend decades mastering it or whatever. You just get used to having a language coming out of your mouth that isn't your native one. And then you've got that boost of confidence. And after that, you can study another language. And this was confirmed by research in, I think it was Sweden or Switzerland. They did a study where they had a group of students who wanted to learn French. So in one group, they gave them 2 years of French. And in the other group, they gave them 1 year of Esperanto and 1 year of French after that. So the second group had less time studying French, and yet they did way better in the exams.
Wow.
So that kind of goes to show that I really feel the first thing you have to do is have that confidence. Get used to using a foreign language. And then you can get into all of the complexities and so on, and expressing yourself and learning somewhat more difficult vocabulary and so on. But yeah, if possible, I'd dive into an easy language first, and then you have the momentum to do it with others.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things that you talk about on your site is the hardest language for you to learn, and we've touched about it a little bit, but you actually say that for you, Spanish was the hardest language for you to learn, which many people would be probably shocked at. But do you care to explain why you talk about Spanish being the hardest language to learn, even though it's considered, you know, an easy language for people who are native English speakers?
There have been studies done by the Foreign Language Institute in America that ranks Spanish as one of the easiest, and then ranks, say, Chinese as one of the hardest. And I completely disagree with this, because this is only taking the grammar and vocabulary differences into account. And you might logically think that's all there is to it, but so much context not involved there. So I always tell people, keep in mind, I've learned some Hungarian, I've learned some Czech, I've learned Chinese, I've learned Arabic, and these languages I found easier than Spanish. And the reason was that Spanish was the first language, and I had all of these doubts and this fear of making mistakes, making a fool of myself, and that slowed me down. Once I got over that, every language afterwards got easier and easier. And, you know, obviously there are components of Spanish that might be easier than this language or that language, but for me, the hardest language to learn in the world was Spanish, because of the context, because of lack of confidence. And people should always keep that in mind, that if you're learning, say, Japanese, if you're passionate about Japanese culture and you have a good mentality and a good language learning approach, then Japanese will be an easier language for you than French or Spanish or anything else, because you have the motivation to get through it. Whereas if I was to force you to learn Spanish or French, then you learn it much slower because you don't really care much about it. And of course, there are people who study these so-called easy languages for years upon years and don't get anywhere with it. So the first thing I always talk about in language learning is confidence and motivation and mentality. These are the biggest issues you got to work on first. And then you start worrying about other aspects and you can get through it a lot quicker.
Yeah, and speaking about confidence and I think also about motivation, what was it that made you decide to start learning a second language? Because like you said, you didn't speak any other languages other than English. You really struggled in school at languages. So obviously it wasn't maybe a passion of yours when you were younger. What was the deciding factor? Hey, you know what? I'm going to stop being monolingual. I'm actually going to go and learn a second language now.
Well, I had already spent 6 months in Spain speaking English the entire time. And then I had been making all these excuses. I met people who have been successfully learning Spanish. And I was like, I don't have language talent. I'm too old. I don't have good memory. And all these things. And then eventually their insistence that it was mostly my own laziness and devotion to these excuses, it got through to me. And I realized I really do have to give this a serious try. I'm living in Spain and I don't speak the local language. So I made a big sacrifice to cut English off entirely outside of work. I mean, I was an English teacher, so I still had to use English. But once I stepped outside of the classroom, I refused to say a single word in English. And this forced me to, you know, have an almost Tarzan style way of expressing myself. Of, you know, me won't go there. And you just get used to it. It's okay. You don't have the right verb conjugations and all that stuff, but people will understand you. And that should always be the priority, is making yourself understood and trying to get the gist of what's said back to you. And this does not require a perfect grasp of the language. You get used to the language and you can perfect it with time. But that changed everything for me. This concept that it was okay to make mistakes as long as I could get my point across with people.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you make a good distinction in the beginning about, you know, what is fluency and kind of what is your motivation for learning language? Is it to be someone who can do it professionally, or is it to be someone who just, you know, wants to be in that country and live that language and have conversation? I think a lot of people probably get hung up on this idea of fluency and like, I have to take a test and pass a test. But for you, obviously, fluency means something a little bit different, right?
Right. And now I have passed these mastery tests. I do have the highest level diploma that you can get in Spanish, for instance, the C2 mastery diploma. So I do appreciate that aspect, that side of it. But even having gotten that level, I can honestly say I don't really need it that much, because the vast majority of the Spanish that I use is a lower level conversational Spanish. When I'm out in a party with people, I'm getting to know them, I'm hanging out and talking about stuff I like, asking them how things are going. And, you know, it's great that I can start discussing trellis code modulation when I wrote my my diploma thesis on. Sure, I can discuss that in Spanish, but is that really something that's so necessary to my normal life? I mean, I really think the priority should be to aim for upper intermediate, because that's what most of us want in a language. You want to be able to live through the language socially. Maybe we can't have the deepest conversations about technical things, but we can still do the vast majority of what we need to do in the language. And I have a very solid understanding of that, and I have an understanding of my limitations. And I can tell people, having reached a mastery level, it's great, but it's just not so necessary for the vast majority of people. And it's okay to be at a level where you still have work to do.
Right. Yeah, I think you can apply the 80-20 rule to that. You know, I mean, you get to an 80% level of understanding, you're going to be able to converse with almost anyone in that language. The extra 20%, if you want to go for it and get that mastery level, that's great. But, you know, it's going to take you a lot. It's going to be a lot harder to get past that. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think they should focus on conversation, because that's what you're going to be doing most of the time.
Right. And the opposite way of looking at it from the Pareto principle is that the 20% that you would have learned in your first month, 20% of the language, is going to cover you for 80% of situations. So even if you are a basic, you know, lower intermediate, it could just about get by. That is going to help you with the majority of things you're going to do in your life.
Yeah, very, very good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're completely right. You know, that 20% is going to cover you for almost anything. One of the things that has always amazed me about you is how you're able to keep the languages straight in your head, and you do a lot of neat YouTube videos where you jump from, you know, one language to another, you know, telling the same thing but doing it in different languages. Do you constantly practice each language to stay fresh at it, or once you've learned it, is it kind of always there? How does that work, you know, inside your own brain?
Well, I would love to say that the work, your work is done at a certain stage, but that's an impossibility. You always have to work on maintaining and improving your language skills. So even with my Spanish and my French, my best languages, I'm still consistently forcing myself to use them in difficult situations, to push them up a level. I don't make so many videos where I switch between languages. I've only ever made 2 or 3 videos like that. Generally, I learn one language to use that one language. And if people do have an interest in becoming multilingual, I would highly suggest they focus on one language at a time. Wait until you're very happy with that language, until you've got it to a fluent level, and only then go on to another language. Because there's a danger to, you know, for people who want to have like 5 or 6 or whatever number of languages, that they spread themselves too thin. So having reached a mastery or a fluency level in several languages, it's just very easy to switch between them because you already speak each one individually very well. So, you know, I can go out to a couch surfing party and I can talk Spanish for a few minutes and switch to French and switch to Italian and so on. But that's only because each one of those languages had my absolute 100% dedication and devotion for several months or an entire year of my life. Right. So, you know, if people are interested in being multilingual, take it one language at a time.
And one of the neat things that you do when you're learning a language is that you then travel, not always, but at least some of the times, go to a country that then you can immerse yourself in that language. How has that helped you in the language learning? And if someone isn't able to do it, how can they recreate that immersion without actually being, you know, in that country?
Well, contrary somewhat to the message of encouraging travel that of course, you want to discuss here, okay, I actually think it's not that great an idea to go to a country to learn the language. And this is coming from the fact that I have done that most of the time. I have gone to the country without anything, with a phrase book, starting from scratch. I've learned the language in the country. And then recently I've done the opposite, and I learned my Arabic in the middle of Brazil, my Egyptian Arabic. And I found that it was a much wiser decision to do it that way and to arrive in the country, you know, to hit the ground running, to already have some good level of the language that I can use immediately. Because the problem is, if you go to the country with absolutely nothing, you, for the first few days or weeks, you're going to want to socialize. You're going to want to share your feelings with people. And the slippery slope a lot of us fall down, and that I myself fell down when I moved to Spain, was to socialize with the expats, the English speakers. And we tell ourselves, it's just while I settle in. And that's just impossible. Right. You can't do that. You can't just while you settle in. I say it's impossible. I mean, I did make the transition from I ditched the English expat group to speaking only Spanish. But it was hard. It was really hard because I had to give up friendships. I had to be a little rude to people and say, look, I don't want to speak any English with you. And these are people I was hanging out with for months. So in my opinion, you're much wiser to learn the language in advance and then arrive in the country already speaking it. And the way to do that, like I always tell people, the way to learn any language efficiently is to speak it from day one. Use it immediately. You don't have to go to the country for this. People might think that's the logical follow-up to that, is you have to go to the country. But all you got to do is log on to Skype. There's so many people on Skype very willing to help you to learn that language. You can do it completely for free if you teach them English. And this is very easy for certain languages like Spanish and Chinese, Mandarin. There are a lot of people in those countries that want to improve their English. So you speak 20 minutes in English and 20 minutes in their language. Or it can actually be very affordable. Like there are teachers in China
who charge $5 an hour, and they're actually earning pretty well for where they live, because they live in the middle of China where it's not expensive.
Right.
So you can, and this is what I did with Arabic, is I had private teachers who lived in Egypt, who I would talk to for 2 or 3 hours a day on Skype. And during these sessions, I would not allow myself to speak English. And it was very frustrating. It was very hard. But I got through that frustration in advance. So when I arrived in Egypt, I was already able to communicate. And I could focus on the cultural immersion rather than spending so much time in the country, locked in my room, studying stuff or getting lessons and all that kind of stuff. It's better if you can learn in advance.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because if you do go to a country knowing nothing, it's going to be pretty miserable. And obviously the desire to want to speak your native language, if it's English and you're somewhere that, you know, people do speak some English, is going to become so overwhelming after a few days, because you want to meet people, you want to have human interaction. And if you can't do that, I feel like it will be very, very tough to keep that desire to say, no, I'm going to learn this language, because you naturally want to have friends. And, you know, right. We're all social beings.
I can do it now myself, but keep in mind, this is because I've got experience doing it.
Right.
I think a first-time language learner would not be wise to tell themselves, right, in 4 months' time, I'm going to arrive in Spain, and I'm going to immediately switch over to only using Spanish. And they don't plan to do any work in advance. I mean, if someone tells me that they have a ticket booked and they're leaving in a few months, then I tell them to make it their full-time obsession right now to learn the language. You know, if you're in the country right now listening to this, you can indeed make that transition. You can start to prioritize not spending time with the English speakers. And I can tell you from experience, you will have a very frustrating few months. But then those frustrating few months are in exchange for the best years of your life. Yeah. Like my first months of dedicated time to not speaking English and learning Spanish were very hard for me, because I could not express myself in so many things I wanted to say. But in going through that frustration, because of that, I've got Spanish for the rest of my life, and I've had deep conversations. I've made some amazing friendships with people who don't speak any English, and it's because I made that sacrifice. So people who are in the country right now, they can indeed get into learning the language if they're okay with that frustration for the long-term investment. And if you're not in the country right now, then great, because you can put in several hours a day to get your progress started, so that when you arrive, you already speak the language a little bit.
Yeah, great point. And you've learned, obviously, a ton of different tips, tricks, methods. I don't think there's anything that, you know, there's no magic pill you can swallow and learn to a language. But in the last 10 years, you've learned a lot of stuff. You've packed a lot of stuff into your, you know, into your Speak From Day One package on your website. What are some of the best tips you can give someone who's just starting out? And you mentioned Skype, and I think that's a great one, because nothing beats, obviously, speaking it. What are some other things that people can do to start learning a language?
Right. Well, one of the major mistakes, in my opinion, that a lot of people in America make is they think that the amount of money they invest will automatically give them the best return. Yeah. And they immediately drop $500 on Rosetta Stone. I've used Rosetta Stone, and I don't think it's great. I don't think it's worth that amount of money at all. And I have found actually that getting a Lonely Planet phrase book, which is whatever it is, $5 or $10, is great, because that will get you started on saying things you want to say. You want to ask people what their name is, where's the bathroom, how much does that cost? These are the things you really need to say. You need to study. You need to be an independent learner. You can get a lot of free courses online. Another good one is Duolingo.com. It's a completely free course in a lot of European languages, and they're expanding to have other ones. You can try to listen to the radio. What's it called? I forget what it is, but you can just Google the streamed radio for the country you're moving to, and you can hear what natural content sounds like. You can learn vocabulary through a great app that I like called Anki. A-N-K-I. You can download flashcards to that app, and it presents them to you in such a way that it uses a spaced repetition system, which is a very useful approach to not forget vocabulary for people who think they got bad memories. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's not, and as you say, it's not about any magic pill, and I don't think it has been about a particular tool or resource that I found that has changed everything.
Right.
It's more about the fact that because I'm forcing myself to use the language, because I downright refuse to speak English, I have no choice but to get used to making mistakes, to get used to being a little bit more confident, to use whatever the little I know as much as possible, to speak like Tarzan, to do all those kind of things. So it's really just exposure to people. That's got to be the priority. And do not make it about buying things or downloading the greatest app or software, or, you know, buying a ton of books. Just one or two little resources and get started speaking.
Yeah, and I know that you're really active in the couchsurfing community, both as a host and an ambassador. And anyone who knows my background knows I'm a huge advocate of couchsurfing as well. And I'm actually going to have some of the main people at couchsurfing on the podcast in a few weeks. What is it that appeals to you about couchsurfing, both as a language learner, because you kind of already mentioned using that as a tool, and then also, you know, as a traveler in general?
Well, I haven't actually stayed with couchsurfers so much myself. However, I have hosted over 2,000 couchsurfers.
Wow.
In whatever. I joined the site when there was only 10,000 people, and there's like 3 million or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's big now. And
it's very big. But what I do is because keep in mind, I'm kind of traveling and not traveling, because I moved to a new country for 3 to 6 months, and I live there, and I don't travel around. So if I want to maintain my previous languages, what I do is I host couchsurfers. I've hosted people like, you know, when I was learning Dutch in Amsterdam, I remember hosting this lady from Quebec, and I got to practice my French, even though I was in Amsterdam. So this is one resource for one use for me is before you travel, you can host people to get advanced language practice for free because you're giving them free accommodation. Otherwise, even if you can't host people, you can search the city that you live in. Couchsurfing is one of the biggest social networking sites that lets you search per language. So if you're living in Chicago, you might as well search Chicago for people who speak Japanese or whatever language you happen to be learning. And you will find those people and you can message them and say, do you want to grab a coffee sometime? And couchsurfers are the most likely people to say yes, because they're more open-minded, they're less fearful of meeting strangers and so on. So I've messaged people directly, and of course I've gone to the couchsurfing meetups, the parties that have people from all around the world, and I use that as a chance for language practice.
Yeah, I think it's an invaluable tool in both, you know, meeting people and becoming friends and building relationships, and then also, like you said, language learning, because there's going to be people in every city who speak almost any language you can imagine, and, you know, couchsurfing is one of the places that a lot of people kind of come to you know, to meet other people from different backgrounds. And that's kind of the basis of it.
Right.
For you then, obviously you said you travel around, you know, every 3 to 6 months you move somewhere different. Why is traveling so important to you? Like, why don't you just live a comfortable life? Obviously you're an intelligent guy as, you know, electronics engineer in Ireland and just, you know, have the house and the yard and everything like that. Why do you continue to travel?
Well, I did get I did try that. Actually, while I was traveling, I worked as an engineer. I got exposure to how the system works, how you climb up the ladder, and a lot of the unfairness associated with that. And I was not impressed at all. So I kind of got disappointed in the rat race quite early on. And I found that it's not really about earning as much money as possible. I've met a lot of people who do have a lot of money, and they're some of the most unhappy people I know in the world. So I found that rather than earning more money, if I learn to use whatever money I have more wisely, I can have a much richer experience in life in general. And this is why I initially would take whatever job I could find, teaching English, working in youth hostels, and I wouldn't be earning a great wage, but I'd be living it up. I'd be doing cheap things, going to free parties and and getting to know new cultures, meeting new people, expanding my cultural horizons, especially through language learning. And I just think it's amazing. The amount of experiences I've had, especially by getting to know the non-English speakers of a country, have just been immeasurable. And I wouldn't have given it up for the world. I mean, I'm really glad that I was not put down the road of becoming another electronic engineer, because it's a very big world. There's so many things to discover, so many people to meet. It just feels like a pity to spend most of your life in the one city or the one country.
Yeah, very well said. I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a great area. I love coming back here, but to spend all my time here and not see what the whole rest of the world has to offer is definitely a pity. And you are very much a frugal traveler, as you kind of just touched on. What are some ways then, because I know you have a bunch and you speak about on your website a decent amount, what are some ways that you keep costs down when traveling?
Well, one that people are probably not going to be so pleased about is giving up all of your addictions. So I don't drink coffee. I don't drink alcohol. I don't smoke. I don't have a shopping addiction, so I don't need to buy the latest fashion trends. I think this is one of the biggest costs. I've met people who travel, and they've told me that half of their budget goes to alcohol.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you're a traveler who goes out partying all the time. And I do go out partying. This is something people don't really consider. They think by not drinking, you're immediately not having any fun. I go out all the time, and I get, you know, a bottle of water or whatever, and I drink that all night long. And like, whenever you think to have fun, you have to spend money in some way, then realize that that's not the way to do it. There are a lot of frugal ways to stretch whatever money you have. Otherwise, there's, of course, couch surfing for accommodation. I did a bit of hitchhiking as well, and that's an adventure in itself. And it's actually a lot better in many cases than paying for the ticket. You learn to cook, and you cook at home rather than eating out all the time. It's mostly just what you spend. The people sit down and look at their budget and see, where's the money going? You know, if you're paying a mortgage, then sell the house. I mean, that's another thing, is I don't own anything in the world, really, because everything I own weighs 22 kilograms or 50 pounds, 23 kilograms, because I travel with it. So I don't have a car that I'm paying insurance on. I don't have a house that I'm paying a mortgage on. And if people did have these things, they should sell them. And whenever I'm about to leave a place, I'll sell whatever I can, because it's not necessary. The only things I need in this world are the clothes on my back and the computer that I work on. Really, everything else is not so necessary.
Yeah, and I think that, well, when you go to different places, do you rent accommodations? Do you do, you know, you said you're there 3 to 6 months. Does that help keep costs down? Do you rent hotels? Do you stay at hostels or not hotels?
Definitely keeps the cost. Oh, yeah. And this is one thing I'm always sad to see is not on most people's list of ways to travel on a budget, is by speaking the local language, everything changes. So, for instance, when I was in Rio the first time in 2008, I think it was, I managed to rent a penthouse apartment with a spectacular 270-degree panoramic view where I could see the Statue of Christ and the Sugarloaf Mountain. And I had a 200-meter-square huge apartment that I threw so many parties in and whatever. And that kind of thing, you can imagine in Europe or North America, would set you back several grand a month.
Oh, easily, yeah.
I was paying about $500 or $600 a month for the entire place.
Wow.
And the reason for that was because I spoke Portuguese. Yeah. And now in Germany, the place I'm at is like €400 a month. And it's a huge apartment with a piano and right by the public transport. I've got the whole place for myself. And the reason is because I used local options. I did not get this on Airbnb. Airbnb, I do use that a lot myself. If I'm staying somewhere for a couple of days or maybe a week.
Sure.
But if I'm staying several months, then I have to use whatever the local option is for finding advertising accommodation, and they're not catering to tourists because the advertisement is in that language. But if you're still stuck, like there, as I said, there have been times when I go to a place and I don't speak the language yet. What I've done for that, which has been a little trick that worked very well for me, is I hired a personal assistant with just the specific task of finding an apartment for me.
Okay.
And it's interesting because if you go to an agency is much more motivated to give you an expensive place because they earn via commission.
Right.
Or they've got a certain pool that they only look at. But I hired a guy when I went to Istanbul. I think I paid him like $50, and he spent two or three days, like looking up all of the advertisements in local newspapers in Turkish, and visiting them, and recording a quick video with his iPhone, and then emailing this all back to me. And then I said, I want that one, and then I wired him the money, and he paid the deposit, the down payment in cash. And it was waiting for me. So I went straight from the airport to this lovely apartment.
Wow.
And I forget how much I was paying, but I was paying way less than everyone else I met who were other foreigners hanging out there. They paid the what I like to call English-speaking tax, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can outsource it to someone who speaks the local language, or if you do it yourself, it's more direct.
Yeah. And now how did you, that's really interesting. And I like that you also did it without speaking language. So if someone is in that situation, you know, there's a great tip for you. How did you find the person in Turkey then to outsource it to? Was it a friend? How do you know you can get someone that you're going to trust, I guess?
I used Odesk and Elance.
Okay.
These are the two biggest outsourcing websites. And you know, you can trust them because you generally would hire someone that has a lot of good rating on the site. Same with Couchsurfing, someone that has good references, or with eBay, someone that has a lot of five-star reviews. It's the same kind of thing. You know, you can trust them because of that. I outsourced this guy and I said, you know, if you can get it within this certain budget, then I'll give you a bonus. And I pay whatever it was, $50 or $60. And that was the best money I've ever spent because I saved so much. And I did the exact same thing when I moved to Taiwan. Because I also arrived in Taiwan without speaking any Mandarin, but I outsourced the apartment hunt. And this guy found it, once again, an advertisement entirely in Chinese. And I had this fantastic studio right by an MRT, which, oh man, I was paying something like 200 euro a month or something.
Wow.
Like in the center of Taipei.
Yeah.
So it's you can get very, very far if you're using local sources, or as I said, you can outsource it on one of these sites.
Yeah, great, great, great tip. I've used Odesk, not for that, but for other stuff that I need outsourced and all, you know, with my website and all, and always been very happy. You know, it obviously these people are vetted beforehand and they have references and, you know, people have rated them for the jobs they've done. So that's an awesome tip, Benny, one I've actually never thought about. So thanks for that. Another thing that I liked on your website, you talked about your love you loved haggling, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think you said you learned it from your time that you spent in India, which if anyone's been there, they know haggling is kind of, it's not just something, I mean, it's something you do naturally. You have to do it.
Yeah.
So I've embraced haggling 100% when traveling. What's been your best haggling strategy, and then what do you, you know, what's been the best thing that you've gotten from haggling? Like something you could say, man, I got such a steal on this.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you actually in India itself, the deal I got. I was in Goa in Palolem, I think, and I managed to get a hut on the beach, an entire hut to myself, for $3 a day. Now, what happened was, and something I always tell people, the Indian way of haggling involves never saying a price yourself, because when you say a price, you've immediately set the lower limit.
Right.
So this lady told me $20 a night when I came up to her, and you know, I'm obviously a foreigner and whatever. $20. She said it in rupees, the equivalent of $20. Now instead of me saying $10 and us meeting in the middle, because that's actually what she was expecting. Nearly every foreigner would say $10.
Right.
And then she'd be happy with 12 or 13 or whatever. No, what I did was I listed reasons why it's not a good place to stay. which was kind of ridiculous because it was ideal. I said, for instance, I said, oh man, it's right on the beach. So I got to listen to waves all night long. How am I going to get any sleep? You know, right. Totally illogical thing. And then I was like, and look at this. You're watching the sunset over an island from the porch. I mean, what if I want to read a book and the sun's in my eyes?
For shame.
That's not on at all. It's just absolutely silly things. You look for whatever problem you can find in the apartment and you make it sound like a big deal. And that kind of forces them to say, oh, okay. And they put the price down a little. Obviously, it depends because some cultures would be more reluctant to do this than others.
Right.
But yeah, it's worked for me. And everything in your body language has to scream lack of interest. So you don't face the object you're purchasing. And in that case, I didn't look. I was still walking down the beach and looking over my shoulder at this hut and had a totally disinterested look on my face when I was thinking about it.
Right.
I learned that trick from my sister who had been traveling in India before me. She was traveling with her then boyfriend, now husband. And she told me that like whenever she really wanted something in a market and she wanted him to buy it, she would speak to him in Irish, in Gaelga, that she knew nobody would understand. And she would say words and she, like, for instance, she'd say with like a very disappointed and angry look on her face, oh, toshigahan why, as if she was saying, oh, what a piece of crap. But that actually translates to, that's really good. And, you know, they had this kind of secret code between themselves where her body language would say, I'm not interested in it. But she'd actually be saying, oh, my God, please buy that for me.
Right.
So your body language screams things. If you're really enthusiastic, the guy selling it to you knows that he can give you a high price.
Yeah. Well, even Benny's sister is giving out tips on this podcast. And yeah, those are great, great tips. And I agree. I love, you know, I think haggling is part of the experience when you go to a country that it is, you know, accepted in, you know, Southeast Asia, India, and a lot of non-Western countries, are great for haggling, and it's fun. Not only are you getting a deal, but you're engaging in a local culture, kind of like a tradition, a custom. So I highly recommend it. Yeah. It's good. Thanks for those tips. You've lived now, I think it was 23 countries. You've lived in 23 different countries now. And while most people who travel kind of always dodge this, you know, what's your favorite place question? Oh, I can't pick one. They're all great. I know that you have a pretty specific answer. So what is your favorite country you've lived in and why?
I don't need to avoid this question. For me, it's very easily Brazil. It's my favorite country in the world. I lived there for about a year in total. This is on 4 different visits. And the reason is because of Brazilians themselves, the Brazilian people. They're the friendliest, warmest, most genuine culture that I've ever come across, especially when you speak Portuguese and you can speak to all levels, all classes of society. I just feel so welcome whenever I'm in Brazil. And they're festive. And it's kind of like, you know, like people are nice to me in many Asian countries as well. They're always very courteous and respectful. But the difference is it's Western. So I feel more at home.
Okay.
I feel, you know, it's easier to relate to people. Whereas in other countries where they're also very friendly with me, I still feel a big distance because there's a much wider cultural gap. So Brazil has that kind of Western advantage that I feel a little more at home, but it's still incredibly open and friendly.
Yeah, very neat. I'm sure having that awesome penthouse in Rio didn't hurt very much.
No.
What are some of the other places you've enjoyed then? Are there other places? I mean, Brazil's number one. Are there other countries that you would say, hey, I was here. I had a great time. I'd tell anyone to go here and stuff like that.
One of my favorite places I'm in right now is Berlin. A lot of people don't realize this, but Berlin is one of the cheapest major cities in Europe. It's a great place to live, and there's a fantastic startup culture here. Lots of entrepreneurs and bloggers, and it's an amazing place. And as I said, where I'm living is very cheap. You can eat out all the time, and it's very cheap. So because of that, your money takes you very far, which is not so typical in Europe, because usually European major cities are a little rough on your wallet. So I'd highly recommend Berlin. What else? I'm more a fan of Latin cultures. It's just I relate to them a lot better. So I enjoyed my time in Spain really well.
Okay.
It depends on your personality, you know?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And I would agree that the idea, having your money travel further, unless you're someone who has a ton of it, which most of us aren't, it really does play, at least for me, it plays a lot into the places that I enjoy, because I don't like the feeling of, hey, I want to go out and have this dinner, but, you know, then we can't do this, this, and this. It's really nice to be in places that your money stretches further. You don't have to worry about it. That's one of the reasons I love, you know, Southeast Asia, Thailand, and Cambodia and all, because you're not as worried about it, because you can do the stuff that you want and not have to think, oh man, am I gonna be in the poorhouse if I go out to eat a dinner or something like that?
Right.
What are a few of the places that you're dying to go to that you haven't been to yet, and do you have any plans in the future to head there?
I don't really think of those lines. I only really consider the next 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
So I know I will be going back to America in a few weeks for the summer. But after that, no, not really, because like one thing I know a lot of people have is their bucket list, where they want to do this, they want to experience that, they want to go to this place. And that, I don't really like that concept myself very much. What I've replaced the idea of a bucket list with what I like to call a bucket list. And what this is it involves doing whatever opportunity comes up as it comes up.
Gotcha.
So I didn't have, you know, go bungee jumping on my bucket list, but someone said, hey, we're going bungee jumping this weekend. So I was like, fuck it, I'll do it. It's on my bucket list. So that, I don't have any particular places I really desire to go to. I'll get it, like in most countries, I meet somebody from the country or some aspect of its culture inspires me to go there, and then I start planning to go there. And simple as that, you know?
Yeah.
So I wasn't always dreaming of going to Egypt, but I got inspired about this time last year to investigate Egypt for myself, and then I invested the time into learning Arabic and wanting to check that out.
Yeah, very neat. Where will you be based in America then when you come here in a few weeks?
I'll be staying on the West Coast the entire time. My plan is to drive all the way down from Seattle to San Diego over the space of 6 or 7 weeks.
Ah, very cool.
And I'll be in Portland for about 2 or 3 weeks of that, Portland, Oregon.
Okay. All right. Very neat. Yeah, I'll be out in Portland in the beginning of July. So if you're there that time, maybe we can end up meeting up.
Absolutely, yeah, for the World Domination Summit.
Yeah, I'll be there too, so that's great. Well, Benny, your site is an amazing resource for anyone interested in language learning. You know, also you speak about your travels, so that's really fun to read about too. I've been thrilled at watching how your site and your community has absolutely grown and exploded in the last 5 years since I started following you. And I know there's going to be a ton of people listening to this podcast who will be inspired by your message. So before I let you go, if you wouldn't mind, tell listeners, you know, where they can find you online, what you offer, how they can come connect with you, stuff like that.
Sure. So people can check out my blog, fluentin3months.com, or watch my videos on YouTube. The channel is Irish Polyglot. I also share my favorite videos and links on Twitter at Irish Polyglot. And on Facebook for 3 months. I try to make sure my blog is completely free, spam-free, no advertisements. But I do support it with sales of Speak From Day One. So you can go to speakfromdayone.com to check that out. But otherwise, the best thing is if you go to 3months.com, you can click my TEDx talk. And that'll give you the biggest burst of inspiration and ideas for language learning.
Yeah, and I've watched that. It's a great speech that Benny does at TEDx. And listeners, if you've been listening to Benny today and been thinking, man, I've always wanted to learn, you know, insert any language here, there's no better time to start than now. So go connect with Benny. He's got an awesome website. It's easy to navigate. He's got tons and tons of knowledge on there. It's all completely free. He's also an incredibly helpful and passionate guy, and he'll get you started down the path of language learning. If you have a question for Benny that we haven't answered here in the podcast, you can leave a comment over on the post at extrapackofpeanuts.com. I'll make sure Benny gets them and we can work something out with answers to that. But he's given us a ton of information now. So, Benny, once again, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks a million for having me.
And guys, if you like the podcast, don't forget you can subscribe to it on iTunes. If you're really feeling generous, you can go ahead and give it a rating. And remember, if you want to make your travel dreams a reality, you can visit extrapackofpants.com, the number one place for frequent flyer knowledge and cheap travel tricks. So thanks for joining us, everyone. It's been great. Thanks again, Benny. And until next time, happy free travels. Yeah, well, you don't have to worry, 'cause we're going there soon. You don't have to worry.